What's up? It's Smoke E. Diggler from Drew Hill and Player. Welcome to Season 2 of Reviews and Done with your host, Derek Dunn. Stay tuned for the freshest flashback album reviews and A1 interviews.
What up, world? Once again, welcome to another episode of Reviews and Done on this historic inauguration day where we inaugurated the first female president who also happens to be a woman of color. So that in itself is exciting, but I'm also excited because I get to talk to one of my favorite writers whose work I've been following for a year. This brother, he did the goal of something I wanted to do when I was pursuing film. That is, he wrote the life story of New Edition and brought it to the big screen a few years ago. He also adapted Bobby Brown's story, and this coming Saturday, we get the chance to see this brother's take on Salt and Pepper's life story. That's right, folks. I'm talking about my man, the guy, the man, the myth, the legend, Mr. True. Abdul Williams.
Thank you, man.
Welcome to the line, sir.
I appreciate it. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Oh, thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to chop it up, man. Like I said in the intro, it's just talking to you is like the icing on top of what we watched today when Vice President Harris was sworn in. So, talking to you is just keeping positive momentum going for today. So, again, thank you for taking time out to chop it up.
Oh, absolutely.
All right, so let's get right into it. So, before we get into the biopic, since you're like the go-to biopic guy now, what was your inspiration to become a writer when you first started out?
I've just always been interested in storytelling, even from when I was a kid. I kind of backed my way into it. When I came out to California, I didn't necessarily know that this was going to be my career. I started off in development on the other side, where I was reading scripts for different producers and directors and giving notes and all that, writing what they call coverage, which is like a book report on the script, but basically being like a gatekeeper. And I had always written, I just didn't have the confidence that that could be my path. But after reading, 1,000 or so scripts over the course of the time that I was doing that, it gave me the confidence to pursue my own stories. So that was really how it started for me.
Cool. And if I'm not mistaken, Lottery Ticket was your first published credit, right? That made it to the big screen?
Yeah, I had been writing for a while before that, but yeah, that was the first one that got made.
And with Lottery Tickets, that was Bow Wow and Brandon T. Jackson. So right. What was the inspiration behind you writing a Lottery Ticket? Was it trying to create like a Friday for the 21st century for a younger crowd?
More or less, that was part of it. It was the idea was by the director, Eric White. We were managed by the same company, and he had that idea for a while. It wasn't fully fleshed out, but he knew that he wanted to do something about somebody from, the neighborhood buys a winning lottery ticket. And, although it's this huge thing, this is going to change your life, it also creates some problems, especially if you can't cash it in right away and everybody finds out about it. So when he told me that, then, it sparked my imagination. And I said, okay, what if it was, a holiday weekend, give him one more day that he has to keep it a secret. And he'd have to be, do I trust my friends? Do I trust my family? All this other kind of stuff. So it really just came from that. And we just had fun developing it together. It had kind of a journey. We sold it one place and then there was the writer's strike. So it had to go on the shelf and then another place bought it. But finally, when Ice Cube got involved and he was also a producer on it, that really just kicked everything into high gear. We were able to get a green light, cast Bow Wow. And then we got, just a great cast, even people, big actors taking small roles just to be in it, Charlie Murphy and Mike Epps and, Loretta Devine, the Tori Naughton, all these great talents, whatever. So, and I've just been very pleased, to see it live on over the years and how, people just, it's just one of those things that when it's on cable, which it comes on a lot, they'll stop and they'll watch a little bit of it and laugh.
Yeah, and I want to commend you. There's a great scene, a Lottery Ticket. I think it's probably the strongest scene in the movie where Bow Wow's and Brandon T. Jackson are up on the roof. And right. Brandon has this very strong monologue where he's talking about, what are we going to do? It's like, the money's here and right. We ain't got nothing. So When I saw Brandon do that and the way he brought your first life, I'm like, yo, Brandon T. Jackson needs to do something dramatic because he really nailed your lines with that. All right, so after a lottery ticket, I got to shout out my son who's a wrestling fan, and he loved what you did with Surf's Up 2.
Oh, boy. Not many people have seen that one, but so thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
WrestleMania. So yeah. How did that fall into your lap, and how did you?
Honestly, that was I have a daughter. She's 8 now, but my daughter was just born, and I was at a point in my career where I was trying to figure out, like, urban comedies were not getting greenlit like they had been before, and the business was changing a little bit. It's before like streamers really kind of took over, and so and that's primarily what I wrote was, urban comedies. So I had a meeting with my agent at the time, and he was like, hey, you just had a child. Have you ever thought about writing anything, for like a family audience? You know what I mean? And I was like, yeah, I thought about it. I was like, I don't know anyone in that world or whatever. So it basically came from there. He's like, I'm gonna start putting you up for jobs, for like, maybe Disney Channel or animation and stuff like that. And I said, okay, yeah, it sounds like a cool chat. So that job came up, and I hadn't seen the first movie. I didn't know anything about surfing. I didn't know anything about penguins, but I was like, it's like any other thing. You research it, you learn the world, figure out the characters, figure out what the story is. And it ended up being a really fun project to do. I would definitely go back and do animation again. And at some point, I haven't had any chance to, but I'm glad that I had that experience.
Cool. So speaking on animation, before we get into the biopics, let's say, what would be your dream project from a biopic standpoint to tell in animation form?
An animated biopic? That's a tough one. I don't know. It's I'm sure that could be done, and maybe you have the right subject matter, or the right artist, or if it doesn't even necessarily have to be music. But yeah, nothing comes to mind right off the top that I would do like an animated version.
If I could have anything, I think you'd probably slay something with the Jacksons. I'm a big Jacksons fan, and I was I just had two diehard Jackson fans on my podcast on Monday, where we talked about the Jacksons' work with Gamble and Huff. And it's like, people rarely give that era attention. That's like one of my biggest gripes with the biopic, was they didn't focus on nothing with Gamble and Huff. So seeing like you do something with the Jacksons in the 70s with afros and just the whole vibe would be dope to see.
Yeah, I get it.
From an animation standpoint.
Yeah, sometimes with things like that, it's also, you have to license the music. What I mean? And so they might have, they paid a lot of money, obviously, to license all that Motown. And then it's like, okay, now we got to pay money to, whoever Gamble and Huff deal was with. Sometimes, things like that just come down to financial decisions. Not that, and also like how much screen time you have. But to your point, I'm a big fan of that era as well. And that could be something to focus on.
Cool. Well, in 2017, you just blew up, in my opinion, with the long-awaited, the highly anticipated New Edition story that aired on BET, which was a ratings bonanza. Just even now, 4 years later, man, you just see people and all the groups talking about New Edition stories on again. I'm watching it. So take us back to the beginning and how the New Edition story started for you as a writer.
Okay. Believe it or not, it took so long to get done. That project and Lottery Ticket, I started on right around the same time. Lottery Ticket, I think, sort of towards the end of 05, and then New Edition came to me in early 06. And the way that happened was a producer, a friend of mine, he knew another producer who had been, Jesse Collins, who I've done two movies with now. And Jesse at that time was, working for another guy. He, wasn't where he is now, but he had a background in radio, and he used to also produce, which he still does, a lot of award shows like for BET. So for one of the BET shows, their 25th anniversary, they had New Edition as like the headliner. And so, Jesse got to see kind of upfront, because he produced the award show, like how they work, how they don't work, what's great about them, what's dysfunctional about them, whatever. And he thought, I see a movie in this. So he kind of, struck up a friendship with the guys. Like, he hadn't never done a movie before, but he kind of convinced them, I could get your movie made. So they trusted in him. Through this mutual friend, Jesse found me. He just kind of cold called me and said, hey, you know, I've read some stuff of yours. There was a spec script that I wrote years ago that was set in the music industry. It never got made, but he liked the sensibility that I had. And he's like, I think you have, you know, a voice for this. Would you have an interest in doing a movie about New Edition? And I said, yeah, you know, I'm a huge fan. I grew up on their music, you know, for sure. So it, you know, it started that way. And then basically he was like, okay, well, let me just put you on the phone with a couple of the guys and just, you know, get a vibe and see if they're comfortable talking to you. So I think I spoke to Ricky and Mike that very first day, and they just started, like, they had a lot on their minds that they wanted to get off their chest, you know, and they started telling me these stories, and I started writing them down. And so that went well. So then, you know, they talked to another member, says, okay, you can talk to this guy. And it just went on and on like that. So throughout all of 06, that's what I was doing, was just interviewing them, interviewing people close to them, bodyguards, former managers, family members, like whoever, right, to just figure out what this story was. And then we ended up selling it. It was originally supposed to be a feature, kind of like Straight Outta Compton. We ended up selling it in early 07, but that was another thing that got affected by the writer's strike. And then by the time I was able to work on it again, it had lost momentum, and it took us forever to get it going again. But eventually BET showed really strong interest. They always kind of had been interested in it. And there was like an exec there who was a big fan of it. This guy, Stephen Hill, and Jesse and I met with him, and he said, you know, not only am I going to do it, but I want to do this as a mini series and give you 3 nights, 2 hours each night. And we were like, we'll take it. So, and so that was that. So we started, you know, I revamped it throughout 2015. We shot it in 2016, came out in 2017.
Cool. Cool. Yeah. You, one of the biggest things for me, the first time I saw it, I saw it at a screening here in DC with the cast. Jesse was here. Melvin Jackson was here, who played Curtis Blow.
Yep.
And, you know, I'm an album creative reader. So the minute I saw that you had Jeff Dyson in the film, I was like, yeah, this probably is research.
Cause, yeah.
You know, because yeah. Jeff is a name that only diehard yeah. fans know who
even know,
Jeff yeah. Dyson is. So shout out to you for
thank you.
That. So with a New Edition, I think for me, one of the biggest things that was surprising to me that you didn't include was the Bad Boy run. Was that just for legal purposes, or
no, that
guys,
was
not going to go there?
It was just time. It was just timing. You know what I mean? Like, we even with all the time that we had, 2 hours each night, but it was with commercials or whatever. And like, invariably, some things have to be cut, because you just don't have the time to fit it all in. The other thing with that was, it was like, we found that we were repeating the same points, like dramatic points sometimes. So like Bad Boy, it starts off and it you know, them getting that deal, and you think it's going to be like reinvigorate New Edition, but then it doesn't go like how they think. And then their dysfunction causes like it, you know. So we found, like, we were like, you know what? We keep saying the same thing in night three. Let's like settle on something, you know, like an event. And we said, okay, we're going to do the Home Again tour. You know what I mean? Because that really shows you everything about, like, have they learned their lessons from when they were younger? No, they didn't. And this is why it ended this way. And this was the fallout from it. So we thought that was just a strong way to go, to say everything we wanted to say without getting into a lot of the other things that happened to them in the 90s and 2000s.
Cool. Was there anything in your research that you were surprised to learn about? It was like an OMG moment for you?
All of it, man. Because, you know, I was a little naive to a lot of the ways that groups work, where you think that they're all friends or that everybody, they are friends. I shouldn't say that, but that everybody gets along all the time and everything, you know, because like you see them in concert and you see videos and you hear all these songs and, you know, and you feel like it's all, you know. So I was surprised that there were still a lot of issues, even when we started, and all even going through shooting the movie, there was still a lot of unresolved feelings and things that they needed to work out. So we would even kind of joke about it, that it was like doing that movie was therapy for all of them.
Cool. And shout out to you again for part three, where, you know, Ricky has his OD movement, his breakdown.
Right.
And the way that Elijah Kelly delivered your dialogue when he's in a rehab, and how Chris Robinson just had the camera like focus on Elijah Kelly to really go into that man's struggle with his monologue. So that was another dope monologue that you wrote for Ricky Bell that Elijah Kelly delivered with a very tactful taff, if you will.
Thank you. Well, Elijah was fantastic. I thought he should have been nominated for that role, honestly. And I'm a huge fan of his. And Chris, I mean, just made magic happen. He shot it so well and captured so much. And in a short amount of time with the budget that we had, Chris just did such an amazing job. I'd love to work with him again. We stay in touch and we've talked about like trying to find that next project. But I'm glad you like that. And then, you know, for Ricky to reveal that, something that it was very personal to him that he hadn't let people in on, even some people who knew him a long time didn't know that. So again, that was part of his healing, was to share that and to keep him on his sobriety. So I was glad to have been a part of it in some way.
Was there anything from the New Edition story that you wrote that didn't make its way to the screen?
A lot of things. I mean, a lot of things. Again, you know, there's only so much time, and this is, you know, recurrent. You're going to hear this answer from me a lot, like with everything. There's only so much time, screen time that you have. Like, things are always cut, even things that you shoot that get cut. But probably the thing, if I could, you know, go back and give us the money and the days to shoot it, that I would have loved to shown is the real way that Johnny Gill came into the group and how integral Mike Bivens was into making that happen. There was so much that happened behind the scenes with that. The fact that Johnny couldn't dance when he first joined, you know, the group, and how they were really sweating that, and you know, the work that Brooke Payne did to get him, you know, and the work that Johnny himself did to become like a really great dancer when he couldn't dance really at all at first. There was so much that went into it that we wanted to show. But we had to make some creative choices because, again, it just wasn't money and time. So we just had to find a way around it. And, you know, what I've had to realize over the years after getting, you know, projects done is the audience, I know these things are missing, but the audience, when they see it, they don't know it. Most of them don't. So they're not sitting there like watching like, oh, you know, why didn't you put this in or that in or whatever? They're just enjoying the experience. You know what I mean? So I give myself permission and don't beat myself up that I couldn't cram in everything I wanted. And sometimes it's even better when you don't. You don't need to put every single scene that you wrote in there.
Yeah, true that. And I can say as a fan, you know, it's stuff that I know that I'm a diehard fan. I'm like, you don't need to include everything, you know, caveat on your point, because some stuff is it's just not gonna transition well to the screen.
Right.
And there's only so much that you can, you know, that you can tell where, you know, like you were saying earlier, it becomes repetitive, you know, over exactly. time. And sometimes it's just something simple as a little line is all you need to say. Or like when you were talking about the reunion and you have a thing where it's Jeff and Brooke, and Brooke's like, yeah, you know, mm-hmm. their second album didn't really do anything. Right. And that's something like, you know, the fans know that and right. the public knows that, but it's like, you don't need to, you know, you didn't need to go into the Hootie Mac era and Ralph Tresvant is going down album. I mean, follow the albums, fellas. Don't get it twisted, but you didn't need to show them, you know, making the album and doing all that stuff. So shout out to you again.
You know your New Edition history. Oh,
yeah. Diehard fan.
Yeah, I can tell.
All right. So following New Edition, you get the Bobby Brown story. Now, did that come into play when Bobby saw like the dailies from
New
Edition story?
Quite honestly, Bobby wanted to do his own story before even New Edition. I mean, but BET was like, no, we're going to do, you know, they weren't sure yet that that's what they want to do. So they wanted to do it in steps. They felt like, you know, let's do New Edition. Let's see how it does. Because, I mean, even as great as we felt about it, you never know until you know how people are going to embrace it or if they are. And, you know, when it became what it became and got the ratings number that it did, then they were sold. They were like, okay, let's strike while the iron's hot and, you know, and do more of this. But Bobby's thing was he didn't want it to just be like a sequel to New Edition story. You know what I mean? He wanted it to be his own thing, its own thing, which it was. It was very different. It was, you know, it wasn't making the same points, you know, that we made in New Edition story. So it was very much a separate thing. And, you know, BET was happy to launch right into it. So I didn't have quite as long of a period to research and write, but I didn't need as much because I'd already done so much. I knew I had a rapport with him already from interviewing him from New Edition Story and other people around him. And so I was able to kind of like, you know, start on first base already, you know what I mean? And go from there.
Yeah, and shout out to my man Woody McClain, who's killing it on Power Book 2 now. But his stuff is Bobby. Like, you know, I don't think a lot of people know that Woody actually started, you know, in comedy, and then he started doing drama, and it was like just a gradual rise. See him go from you know, playing Bobby to where he's at now. That brother's well on his way to, you know, being a force, you know, in black talent.
I agree 100%. Yeah, Woody's
fantastic. In the years to come.
He's great to write for. He's great to work with. He's very, very funny. I hope he gets to, you know, exercise his comedy chops a bit. I mean, he just kind of makes his own stuff. If people don't cast him, and like he makes his own videos and creates his own content, and he's great with it. But he's a Swiss Army knife. He can do drama. He can do comedy. He can dance. He can't sing, although he'll give it a college try. You know what I'm saying? But no, Woody's a good friend, and I'm a huge fan.
So with Bobby's story, was there anything that was in your scripting phase that didn't make it to the thing, similar to Johnny's story?
Yeah, once again, like, you know, there, you know, lots of things that I would have liked to show. I'm trying to think if there's, I don't know if there's like a specific story off the top of my head that with Bobby that I, you know what I mean? Because we were able to get in most of what we wanted for that, most of the big events of his life. There's nuance, you know what I mean? Like, I would have loved to have shown how huge he really was, how internationally huge he was on that Don't Be Cruel tour. I mean, you know, and I'll tell you something, like, it wouldn't have made a whole lot of difference story-wise, but we just thought it was, like, fascinating. The friendship that he struck up with Mike Tyson, and they were just, like, thick as thieves, you know what I mean, for a little while. You know, before Tyson had his conviction. So Bobby was actually with Tyson in Japan when Tyson lost to Buster Douglas, like, because Bobby was on tour there. So they were kicking it. They went to the Emperor of Japan's, you know, palace or whatever. And this is the night before the fight. And they're staying up and they're kicking it, you know, women everywhere, whatever. And Bobby tells Mike at one point, he's like, man, you know, you got a fight tomorrow. Should you really be up this late doing all this? He's like, oh, man, that's just something they tell fighters. Don't worry about me. I'm good. You know what I mean? So Bobby's like, all right. You know, and then the next night he gets upset by Buster Douglas, and Bobby cried. Like, he blamed himself, like, oh, man, I had Mike out too late, you know, doing all this wild stuff. And I mean, that was just one example. They really, like, they kicked it hard all over the place, and we're very tight, you know what I mean? And I would have loved to have shown that, but it was like one of those things where you didn't need to see that to understand Bobby Brown, you know what I mean? It was just like a cool, interesting thing that I could have showed. So that never even really made it into the script. You know, we always, like, we all thought it was dope and funny and cool, but it was like, nah, you don't need this.
Yeah, that's the only thing that I wanted to see. Well, I wanted to see that because when I read the book, and Bobby was telling the story about the tour and how they were driving that big truck and, like, they ran over a car when he was with Tyson and it got stuck in the car. And, of course, I wanted to see a little bit of Bobby's friendship with Tupac that a lot of people don't know about. So if you guys haven't read Bobby's book, then check that out. It's some great stories that piggyback off Mr. Abdul Williams' writing for the Bobby Brown story. All right, so, you know, after New Edition, after Bobby Brown – brings to your current project here on this Saturday, the Salt and Pepper story. What was the writing process for Salt and Pepper story?
You know, it was, you know, much the same way that these have come. It, you know, basically, I took a meeting at Lifetime, and they already had Salt and Pepper's rights, their life rights secured, and they were looking for a writer, and they asked me if I would have interest in it, and I said, well, you know, yeah, I'm interested. You know, I'm a big fan, grew up on their music. And it really just kind of started like that. The next thing I know, they were, you know, hitting up my representatives to make a deal with me to write it. So that was in, end of 2018. And then I met the ladies for the first time in early 2019. And, you know, we just hit it off like, you know, right from the start. They told me what, you know, they were looking to do. Lifetime had kind of a vision for it as well. And we had to kind of, you know, meet in the middle and, you know, and just like New Edition, they had a lot of long time issues that they needed to work out. They had already worked a lot of it out, but, you know, when you have your life story filmed and you have to like relive those experiences. You know what I mean? You have to relive it by reading the script, and then you have to watch it filmed, and then you watch it once it's shot, and then you watch it with an audience and all, you know, all this kind of stuff. And it's not an easy thing to do, to air your dirty laundry, or even, you know, just all of it. I mean, just to relive those things. And so I was aware of that, 'cause I saw it, you know, with any story, and I saw it with Bobby, and I, you know, so I was able to kind of like make them feel comfortable and get them on board with it. But, yeah, that's how it came to be.
And Salt and Pepper's only going to be a one night, right? That's not a miniseries, correct?
Yeah, it's one night, but it's three hours. And it's in the fourth. There's a fourth hour that is unscripted. It's just like a little documentary interview with them.
Cool. Well, I'm looking forward to Salt and Pepper, and I can tell you, brother, man, I spent so much time defending you and big helping you on online, because, like, you know, the biggest thing from the mainstream, you know, John Key moviegoer public is they see Lifetime, they think about the wigs and everything else. I'm like, right. I'm like, I'm telling y'all, look,
right.
Abdul Williams wrote this movie. He wrote New Edition. He wrote Bobby Brown. It's going to be okay. Well,
I appreciate that. I'll say this. I mean, it wasn't just me also. I mean, we had a great experienced director, Mario Van Peebles, who—
Yes, sir. You
know, we had an incredible producer in Bob Title, which, if people don't know his name, Bob Title and George Tillman have State Street. They gave you Soul Food. They gave you the Barbershop movies. They gave you Notorious. You know what I mean? Like, you know, he has The Hate U Give. Like, he's an incredible producer with a great eye, and knows how to develop things well, and knows how to like land the planes on time. So between the three of us, and Cheryl and Sandy were also producers as well. So we didn't get to do anything that they did not approve of. You know what I mean? They had to get the final say. And believe me, they are not pushovers. Like, they don't just, you know, they're very strong women, strong opinions. And if it wasn't right, we had to do it over, you know? So all that to say, I don't take any offense if fans, like, if their first impression is, oh, I don't like the wigs, or she's too light-skinned, or she's not light-skinned enough, or whatever it is. Or if they don't like our casting choices, because I've been down this road before, right? When we announced the cast for a New Edition Story, and it you know, went out into the news services, I saw the exact same tweets. Oh, they don't look nothing like them. Blah, 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 blah. Now, you know, all this stuff, right? Get anybody to admit that now, that they were hating on the casting of New Edition Story. You know what I mean? They won't, you know, those tweets just disappear into the ether, whatever. But I remember reading them, right?
Yeah.
They got into the movie, and they didn't care that Elijah Kelly doesn't look exactly like Ricky Bell. You know what I mean? They don't care. Like, if you get absorbed into the character, you don't care. Same thing when we cast Gabrielle Dennis as Whitney in the Bobby Brown story. I was very, you know, she was very sensitive to that as well, because she was such a huge fan and knew what an iconic role it was. And we looked at like actresses, very popular, very, very famous to unknowns to, you know, I mean, we did a wide expansive search, and nobody could beat her out. Nobody could deliver exactly like the performance that she did. And does Gabrielle look exactly like Whitney Houston? No, she'll be the first one to tell you she doesn't. But when people watched it, and we got the same pushback. Oh, she don't look nothing like Whitney. Da, 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 da. I'm not going to watch this. It's going to be trash, blah, blah, blah. And then they watched it and they forgot all about it, because she embodied the role. So now, my third rodeo with this, I don't trip anymore if people like have. And by the way, fans have every right to be skeptical, because there have been some biopics that have come out that did not, you know, maybe people didn't put the work in, or, you know, whatever, they missed the mark in some ways. I'm not trying to like hate on anybody else's work, right? But I understand the skepticism, but I'm like, give us a chance. Tune in, watch for 5 minutes, watch for 10 minutes. If you're not feeling it, click away. But I have a feeling that once you give it a chance and you see like what we put on the screen, all that'll go away. You won't be focused on wigs. You won't be focused on skin tone. You'll just be like, do I believe this? Am I interested?
Yeah, and, you know, I get it, and it's like, you know, I try not to get it, but it's like, you know, what I do is like, you know, I'll give John Q Public, you know, or Joan Q Public, who doesn't do stuff, I'm like, man, do the research, see who's behind the scenes. Like, this is Mario Van Peebles, Mr. New Jack City, Mr. Panther, directing the movie, Mr. Abdul Williams, he's written two fire biopics, he knows what he is doing, and it's like, it makes me think, you know, back in 92, I can't help but wonder if Spike would have got attacked for casting Denzel as Malcolm X. And mind you, like in 92, Denzel was the guy.
Right, exactly. Well, some people did push back on that. You know what I'm saying? Here's my thing. You're not going to last telling fans and telling audience that they're wrong. Okay. Like, and that's not even my goal, is to, like, you know, well, you're wrong. And, you know, look at my resume. Like, if anything, I want to work to win you over. You know, that's how I look at it. I, you know, and that's how all of us do. I mean, I was very aware, all of us were, doing New Edition story, that it's like, if we get this wrong, every girl we went to high school with is going to hate us. You know what I'm saying? So that, but that's a good pressure to have. That makes you do your best work. That makes you really like, I want to get this right. I want this. I want to get this person's life story. I want to tell a great story. I want to have something that the artist himself can be proud of if they're, you know, on board with it, which, you know, I was lucky on all three of my movies that the artists were involved. And I want their fans to have something, learn something that they didn't know, have a great experience, be able to kind of, you know, walk down memory lane, but also like have an emotional response to it. So I don't sit there, you know, if you're skeptical, that's cool. I'm not offended by that. You know, you have every right to be. And I mean, and Salt and Pepper has nothing to do with Bobby or New Edition. Like they're, you know, three separate things, and maybe people won't feel it. I have a feeling that they will, but maybe they won't. And that's okay too.
Cool. Cool. Well, before I let you go, you know, I got to hit you with a couple of, hard questions, like I do all my interviews. But before we get to the hard questions, what advice can you offer anybody that wants to possibly pursue writing or adapting someone's life story for the big screen?
Boy, do your research. Research is your friend. If you're going to do a bio specifically, know more than you're ever going to put into your script. You know what I mean? Know that person's life, really study it. And, do your interviews, if you know, interview them if you're able to, and if it's, you know, someone who's passed away, do your research on them. Interview everyone you can connected to them, and if you can't do that, if it's like a historical figure, whatever, just read as much as you can, watch as much as you can, not just about them, but the era that they lived in, what was going on in the world, because that's also like what shapes a person, you know what I mean? So, you know, what music was being played, what was going on in the news, that kind of stuff. Basically what I'm saying is just immerse yourself. Like, you know, when you want to learn another language and they do like immersion where you have to just go to that country and, you know, you learn, it's sink or swim, learn to speak it. That's, I think, the level of dedication it takes when you're writing a bio on somebody. And just be a good open listener and have a point of view. You know what I mean? It isn't a documentary. You're not, you know, you want to fly on the wall for a lot of the scenes from their life. So you have to be a good listener and catch, you know, everything from how they talk to what the spirit of it was, what, you know, and put all these events together and have something that you're trying to say with the movie. It's not just, you know, Wikipedia. You don't just want to give the facts. You know what I mean? You want to have like a point of view of something that you want the audience to take away from it.
Cool. Cool. So let's get into these tough questions. Mm-hmm. So, start to finish, what's a stronger, complete project? Bobby Brown, Don't Be Cruel, or New Edition Heartbreak?
Oh, I can't answer that. It's a complete matter of taste. I mean, I know the story of both of them, and I'll put it to you this way. There is no group, and I don't care if it's the Rolling Stones or, I mean, the only ones you could say is the Beatles, that had that much individual success away from each other, where like all their members went off and did projects and they were as successful or as big as they were when they were a group. So those two are iconic albums that really kind of help define the decade, define the sound of, you know, specifically with Don't Be Cruel with New Jack. And, you know, listen, I mean, they're start to finish. You don't skip a song. Like they're just completely dope. So I can't answer that. And so people have also asked me like, what was bigger, Poison or My Prerogative? I really couldn't tell you, bro. I know they made a lot of money on both.
All right. I'll let that one say, yeah, it's because people ask me the same thing. And I'm like, man, you know, both of them, man, I can be on a road trip and have my iPod on random. And if a song comes on, or the album hits, you know, I let them both go, start to finish.
Yeah, they were, you know, they were fortunate. They had the talent to do it, but they also hit on the biggest songwriting producers of the era, Babyface, Teddy Riley, and Flight Time, you know, Jimmy and Terry. You know what I mean? Like, you can't get bigger than the art, than the producers. So they help, you know what I mean? Yeah, Jimmy and Terry already with Janet, they were already super huge, but New Edition definitely, you know, brought out the best in them too. And, you know, Ellie and Babyface and Teddy for Bobby's album. I mean, it was just like, that's the murderer's row in terms of like the talent that you had to give you those iconic albums. And that's the reason they've held up so long.
If you could write a jukebox musical centered around New Jack Swing or the boom bop era of hip hop, which one would you write first?
Probably the hip hop one, just because I haven't. I can't quite release the details right now, but there's something that that era is on my mind because there's something I'm developing right now, but I can't speak on it yet because it's not there yet. But but either way, you can't go wrong because New Jack was also. You know, I'm about to be 49. I'm 48 now, and that's the music that defined my era, my best years.
Cool. And for this last tough question, what, in your opinion, from stuff that you have, Brent, what do you think is the greatest biopic that you've ever seen?
Boy, God, that is tough. I don't even know if I can answer something like that. I mean, there's so many. You know, if you want to just like, you know, you mentioned one of them earlier that I think is one of as good as it gets is Malcolm X. You know what I mean? Just performance and every, you know, learning something that you didn't know and just taking you really into a world. That's one that I've watched time and time again. And I reference it all the time just of how well done it was. But like, in terms of, I don't know if you meant music bios, what can I say? What's Love Got to Do With It? That was a great one. I mean, there's so many. That's a really tough question to answer.
Yeah, and you know, in every interview I ask that question in some form because I just love biopics. And I think for me, the thing about biopics is I think everyone has a story. It's just a matter on the angle that the director or the writer wants to tell. Like, I mean, you know, who would have thought that Kim Powers would do what he did with One Night in Miami, to where it's not a traditional biopic, but it tells a story that we didn't know about. And like one thing that I would love to see is when people talk about like Janet, well, we all know Janet's basic story, but Janet Jackson's era from Dream Street to Control and how she was doing stuff on Good Time when she was an actress first is a classic underdog story, because nobody expected Janet to blow up the way she did in 86. In 86. So I mean, it's a classic underdog story that you could easily tell in 2 hours on the big screen.
Oh, I think you'd need even more than that if you really want to tell her story. But I feel you on that. Yeah, no, she's amazing. And the music would be, Janet, if she ever decides to tell her story, could slay.
Well, all right, folks, I want to thank Mr. Abdul Williams for stopping by out of his busy writing schedule to chop it up. I'm a huge fan of this gentleman's writing. I'm looking forward to seeing Salt and Pepper this Saturday on Lifetime. And, sir, where can fans find on social media? And is there anything else you'd like to add?
I'm on Instagram at Abdul the Writer, a few things cooking right now, but nothing that I can speak on just yet.
Cool. That being said, folks, as always, you know, I like to end up with a quote, and keeping with the presence of VP Harris, let's go to the book of Kamala Harris. Anyone who claims to be a leader must speak like a leader. That means speaking with integrity and truth. Until the next time, done out.
The deuce, when did I start podcasting? Anywho, today's episode of Reviews and Done is sponsored by the Pock Collection and Herbalism. Check them out on the gram.